Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. If you have any questions or comments about Current State, you can email us at currentstate@wkar.org. If you'd like to join in on the conversation, follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State.
Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore here on 90.5 WKAR. We're glad you could join us here today on Thursday, 2 p.m. this afternoon, Cadillac Place, Detroit. Michigan Governor Rick Snyder is expected to announce Detroit's incoming financial manager, and here to help us understand where we're at on this historic day, the Michigan Public Radio Network's Capitol correspondent, Rick Pluta. Hi, Rick.
Good morning, Mark.
This has is this the worst kept secret so far of 2013? it seems that way.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of this has been, you know, behind closed doors. Of course, a lot of it has played out in the open. You know, the process where the state review team that went into Detroit and told the governor that there's a financial emergency, the governor's acceptance of that report and his belief that Detroit is in a financial emergency, the city council's appeal of that determination, and what we're expecting today is that the governor will formally ratify his earlier decision that Detroit is in a financial crisis. It's hundreds of millions of dollars in debt with no workable plan to get out, and he'll name an emergency manager. The Detroit Free Press has reported that that person is an attorney out of Washington, D.C., whose experience includes working on the Chrysler bailout is Kevin Orr. And then from Detroit, everything will move back to Lansing, because the governor really, you know, who he chooses is a recommendation, a suggestion. The hire is officially made by an obscure panel called the Financial Emergency Loan Board, and they will actually
vet the decision.
Yeah, they'll
approve the decision.
They'll approve the decision. They'll make the hire. They will set a starting date for the emergency manager, and that date will be the point in time when control of the city moves from the mayor and the city council to the emergency manager.
And assuming Kevin Orr is indeed the man, what do we know about him?
Well, like I said, he's with a high-powered Washington, D.C. law firm. He worked in the Chrysler bailout. He has 2 degrees from the University of Michigan, his undergraduate degree and his law degree. Somewhat ironically, he attended law school with Mike Duggan, the Detroit mayoral candidate who's been very critical of the decision to name an emergency manager, the apparent decision to name an emergency manager over Detroit. And so he has, you know, he has some Michigan roots. What the governor said he was looking for in an emergency manager for Detroit is someone who has large experience in large organization turnarounds, and, you know, he would seem to fit that bill, and communication skills, and Mr. Orr is apparently frequently testifies before Congress, lectures at law schools and other forums. So, you know, that would seem to fit the bill too.
And there is this issue of the city council, not Mayor Dave Bing, from what I understand, but the city council considering legal action. Could this unfold? Could this gum up the appointment?
Well, you know, as we know, anyone can file a lawsuit. And so what we're going to see next, presuming what happens, is, and not just by the city council, that there will be people who are residents of Detroit who presumably will file lawsuits as well. And then we'll get into arguments over things like standing. And so the question as far as the city council goes is this: can the city council independently go to court and file a lawsuit, that is, members of the city council? Or does that require the mayor for them to have standing? The mayor is not happy about the emergency manager, but Dave Bing has said that it's time to accept that reality.
Right. Thank you, Rick Pluta. Appreciate it a lot.
My pleasure.
All right. From breaking news in Detroit to breaking news in Lansing, Current State's Kevin Lavery has already today been at the early morning meeting of Lansing's financial health team at the Ari Olds Museum. The meeting started at 7:30, and we are getting the team's final assessment of how to revise municipal finance and revenue here in the capital city. We do face some shortfalls that's been on the mayor's radar for a long time. Kevin, good morning. What have you learned this morning?
Good morning, Mark. Well, we have learned that the plan is essentially intact. There could be a few minor changes. This is a draft proposal, but it is expected to be completed certainly over the weekend. It's going to be presented to Mayor Brunero on Monday in the afternoon and then to the city council later that evening. Former Mayor David Hollister, who chairs this committee, is calling this Lansing 2.0, and he is stressing that this is not going to be business as usual. He says this is a fundamental restructuring of city government. There are a couple of different reports involved here, one of which is from the Long-Term Solutions Group. Much of it has to do with pension systems and benefits. Some city employees in Lansing do not participate in Social Security now, so the city is recommending that all employees move toward 100% participation in Social Security and then reduce the pension costs that the city incurs to offset that non-participation. There are many recommendations involving pensions, also retiree health care. One recommendation is that the city should move to a uniform schedule for vesting in retiree health care benefits that is consistent with best practices in other adjacent communities. It also gets into health care. And then there are, of course, some regional recommendations as well, one of which is that the city and the school district should explore the possibility of combining their facility for municipal offices and school district offices. And one that's pretty significant is looking into the possible sale of Lansing City Hall and relocating City Hall to a different building.
How about that? That is some interesting stuff. Well, the mayor, Mayor Brunero, gave Dave Hollister a big charge and charged him with being visionary, being revolutionary if need be, because this is a huge concern of Mayor Brunero's. Some potentially really thorny issues involving municipal consolidation and service sharing here, though, too. They did get into that this morning.
Yes, they absolutely did. Mayor Brunero had charged this team with cutting $9 million, and this proposal cuts $12 million. So this has gone above and beyond. David Hollister did make a point of saying that this is not Detroit. Lansing is a well-managed city, but it simply needs to do better with sharing, consolidating, and defining its core services. A theme that came up in the meeting is we simply cannot do all things for all people. We have got to do less with less. Matter of fact, Hollister even said, this may be too much too fast. This may be something that the next generation of leadership may have to tackle. So these are not easy problems, not fixable with a stroke of a pen, but people on the team are very confident that this will put the city on a very drastic and very necessary path toward financial recovery.
Excellent, Kevin. Thanks for your help this morning on
this.
Thank you. We also want to point out that tomorrow morning on Current State, the Lansing Financial Health Team leader, Dave Hollister, joins us. Thanks again, Kevin.
Annuncio vobis gaudium magnum, avenus papam.
That's Cardinal Jean-Louis Touraine yesterday at Vatican Square announcing the election of Pope Francis. A huge throng in the square for that announcement. Monsignor Jerry Vinke of the Diocese of Lansing is stationed at the North American College in Rome. We've connected with him in Rome to discuss the selection of the next head of the Roman Catholic Church, Pope Francis the First. Good morning, Father Jerry.
Yeah, good morning to you. It's great to talk to you, Mark.
Thank you. Describe the scene and tell us, where were you and the other priests while the cardinals were in conclave?
Well, when the cardinals in conclave, we pretty much go about our daily business, meetings and prayer time and going to class as well. But then and we know what time the smoke's going to come up, and so we all head down to the St. Peter's Square. And last night we headed down there about 6:40, and about 7:10, the smoke came out, and it was incredible, just absolutely incredible. I didn't think it was going to happen last night. I thought it was going to be black smoke again.
How about that? Tell us about Pope Francis, what you've learned about this man.
Well, I didn't know too much about him, but when he got out there last night, it was actually really beautiful about how he just could, you can tell he's a man of simplicity and a man of humility as well. He asked the whole audience to take a few moments of silence and pray for him. And it was stunning how quiet it got for the Holy Father last night. And but then when you read about him, he's a cardinal who's very much into social outreach, cares very much for the poor. People would witness him just going alone to visit the sick and the dying. He visits AIDS patients. There's pictures of him kissing the feet of people with AIDS and so on. So he's a very humble man who has a deep, deep care for the least among us.
What are the main challenges he faces?
Well, I think that the main challenges of the whole church really is just the fact that it's 1.1 billion Catholics in the world, and I think for one thing he's going to be a great witness to the Hispanic community, obviously from South America, first American Pope from the Americas, first Jesuit to become a Pope, and the first by the name of Francis. It's going to be all on us, really. I think the great challenge is going to be always on us. Are we going to be converted, in a sense? Are we going to change ourselves? And I always think that's the key. Our hearts are the ones that's going to need to change. He's going to preach the message by word and example, and our hearts are going to be the ones that needs to accept it. But I tell you, last night, Mark, it was one of the most fascinating once-in-a-lifetime experiences I could ever go through, because it was exhilarating last night. Just absolutely. Just the wait. As soon as the white smoke came out, we had to wait one hour before the announcement, and we're just wondering, could it be an American? Could it be who we're thinking it might be? And then they announced this cardinal.
Where were you when Cardinal Thuram made the announcement?
I was probably about 75 yards from where he was in the square. Jam-packed with people. And it was cold and rainy for a lot of it. But right before he made the announcement, about 10 minutes, it stopped raining, and everybody could put their umbrellas down. It was really something to be there last night.
I'm sure it was. Monsignor Jerry Vinke of the Diocese of Lansing is stationed at the North American College in Rome. Father Jerry, thank you and good luck.
Okay, God bless. Take care.
Its current state on WKAR. Since the announcement last Thursday that Michigan Senator Carl Levin won't be running for office again, many names have been dropped as possible candidates. Arguably, none has been dropped as often as our next guests. Democratic Congressman Gary Peters represents Michigan's 14th congressional district, comprising segments of both Oakland and Wayne counties. Mr. Peters traces his political career back to the Rochester City Council, from there, state senator, Michigan lottery commissioner, and on to the U.S. House. Congressman Gary Peters, welcome to Current State.
Well, it's great to be with you, Mark.
We'll get more into issues in just a minute, but let's address your considerations regarding a Senate run here first. Last Friday, you told the Free Press that you needed to discuss this with your family. Can you tell us if they've given you the thumbs up or not?
Well, certainly it is something that I'm seriously considering. But before I really even talk about that, I just want to say what an incredible career Carl Levin has had in the Senate. We are very fortunate to have his leadership over many years. We still have it for two more years as he continues to focus on some very tough issues that we're dealing with here in Washington, D.C. But as I said there in many places, Carl has really been the conscience of the Senate, really, I think, along the same lines as Phil Hart, who served Michigan yeah. very well for years. And so, you know, having him stepping down and retiring, I think it's very important that we keep that seat as a Democrat, and we're going to have the strong candidate.
Can you tell us more about how your family's responded to this idea, though?
Well, it's a big, very big decision. I'm right now in the new 14th district, and very, very pleased with the current district that I serve, and very excited about the opportunities of bringing city and suburb together. I represent half the city of Detroit and the northern suburbs. First district in history that has the county seat of Oakland and Wayne together. So it's really about bringing our region together, and I'm focused on that. But certainly with Carl's retirement, I've been approached by many, many people, lots and lots of phone calls to consider this. And I've told folks I will definitely give it serious consideration because it's very important. The U.S. Senate seat is very important for Michigan. But it is one in which, first and foremost, it is about family. And that's something that we'll have to spend a little time talking about because it's a big commitment for the next 2 years. It requires basically a 24/7 effort around the state. It's a big state, a lot of people to talk to.
So black smoke is still coming out of the chimney of the Peters house.
Yeah, that's right.
Are you discussing a run with anyone else who may be considering a run?
Right now, I think it's more of a personal decision for me and with my supporters as well, folks who have supported me over the years. And but I have reached out to other folks whose names have been floated as well, and we're having discussions.
Really? I spoke briefly with Bill Ballinger yesterday. Bill's the editor of Inside Michigan Politics about your possible candidacy. Here's what he told me.
The first thing he would have to worry about is whether he's going to have a primary. I think there will be a major effort by the Democrats to discourage other major candidates from running against Gary Peters and give him a clear shot at the nomination. They've got to worry as much or more about trying to take back the governorship. They can't afford to have two competitive primaries going on at the same time. If that's the case and he emerges from a Democratic primary unscathed and in a strong position to run against whoever the Republicans nominate, I think that gives him an automatic advantage going into the general election in 2014.
So, Congressman Peters, are you aware of an effort to streamline this primary process?
Well, I'm not aware of any concerted effort to do that, but certainly Mr. Ballinger is correct. It would be better not to have a primary for whoever the candidate is. Hopefully the party can come together and have a consensus candidate to run. Primary is very expensive, particularly on a statewide basis, and there are a lot of demands for resources. He mentions the competitive gubernatorial race is something that has to be number one on our agenda as Democrats, is to replace Governor Snyder with a new governor, but we also have state house races and other races around the country as well. So not having a primary is a significant advantage if possible, but it's hard to orchestrate something like that. If folks want to run, this is a democracy and people are free to run.
Can you say that you're leaning toward running?
I will say that the encouragement I've gotten has been very strong, the folks are making a very strong case as to why I should run, and I'm giving that real serious consideration, and certainly it does weigh heavily on my thought process.
How long will you take to decide?
I think you have to do this fairly quickly, given the magnitude of the job and the size of the state to really be effective. So, you know, I would say it's not a matter of days, it's not a matter of months, it's a matter of weeks.
Between the governor's and the Senate race next year, I'm led to believe you're more interested in the Senate possibility. Assuming that is true, why?
Well, the Senate allows me to continue the work that I've been doing in the U.S. House. I came in 2008, beat a longtime Republican incumbent who'd been serving in Oakland County. In fact, after I won the the Detroit Free Press said I was the first Democrat since 1893 to hold that congressional seat, and then was able to win re-election despite an incredible Republican wave in 2010. And during that time, I have been focused on the economy, been focused to make sure we have a strong and vibrant auto industry, which is absolutely critical for us here in the state of Michigan. I serve on the Financial Services Committee, and right now I've been focused on reforming the mortgage market, dealing with foreclosure issues, which is also a significant issue, and something that I think we have a great chance of moving forward in the U.S. House this year, working with a Republican from California, John Campbell, on some pretty sweeping legislation. And certainly being in the U.S. Senate allows me to continue the work that I will have done for the previous 6 years in the U.S. House, continue to be a very aggressive advocate for the state of Michigan and for our ability to be competitive and grow and to create jobs here in our state.
We are likely to learn the identity of Detroit's next emergency manager here, our first emergency manager here, later today. How does the appointment of this person impact the political landscape?
In the city of Detroit?
Yeah.
Well, certainly they'll still have an election will go forward for a council and mayor, although the powers would be greatly diminished by the emergency manager. I have been very outspoken in my opposition to an emergency manager to disenfranchise the voters of the city of Detroit is not the way to build a long-term sustainable community. Certainly some very tough choices have to be made, some tough decisions, but ultimately it should be elected officials that make those tough choices that are held accountable to the people and express the will of the people.
Brian Dickerson of the Free Press says Michigan Democrats are somewhere between a state of confusion and panic right now in that the party is searching for direction. How do you assess that?
I think the party's on pretty good ground. So we've got a strong Democratic congressional delegation. We've got some very senior members that I have the privilege of serving with. We have been, I think, a very forceful voice in Washington, D.C. for interests that are important to our state. We've got some great leadership in both the state House and the state Senate. Tim Grimmel and Gretchen Whitmer have done an outstanding job leading those delegations, and I think we'll continue to really articulate a vision for the future, and we will see that play out next year at a campaign time.
What do you think lay ahead regarding funding the federal government later this month? How is that likely to play out?
Well, we are at a very difficult time right now, as you are well aware, Mark, and difficult to find people coming together in the middle. I don't think anybody wants to see a shutdown in government. That's not something that is acceptable. We've got to find some middle ground. But what I've seen from my years here, my last four years in the U.S. House, is that unfortunately these crises kind of get manufactured. They're manufactured crises, which are not in the best interest for the country. They tend to have some resolution, but it's right at the very end. But that's not the way we should be running government. We should be coming together way before that time. But right now, given the polarization that you see in the Congress and the folks who are unwilling to compromise, will probably be pushed against that deadline once again.
We've got less than a minute. Quickly, Congressman Peters, many observers say that Too Big to Fail is alive and well. You worked on Dodd-Frank. Is Too Big to Fail still alive and well?
It is not. Dodd-Frank has a very specific mechanism in place for banks to be unwound. It's basically a living will. If a bank gets into trouble, they will be unwound, similar to the mechanism that we have with the FDIC now. If a bank gets into trouble, the FDIC comes in, unwinds the bank, protects the depositors. Those are fully insured, but the banks disappear. That mechanism is part of Dodd-Frank. It did not exist prior to Dodd-Frank. It was put into the bill, we need to continue to make sure that, one, we also have the reforms, the wide-ranging reforms that came out of Dodd-Frank actually get implemented and put into the rulemaking process and into law. That process is happening now. You're going to see greater transparency and greater oversight of the financial industry, which is absolutely essential to keep Wall Street focused on what it should be focused, which is creating financing and not speculating.
Very good. Democratic Congressman Gary Peters represents Michigan's 14th Congressional District. He's considering a run for U.S. Senate. Thank you, Congressman.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Mark.
Coming up on Current States, our public poetry announcement. And we also will revisit the Japan, the Fukushima earthquake 2 years after. Coming up. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Time for another Current State public poetry announcement. The 6th Annual Festival of Listening is tomorrow night in East Lansing. It's all about poetry. And this event, put on by MSU's Center for Poetry, features live readings of poems in other languages with no translation. It's become, by far, their most popular event. And here to tell us more is Stephanie Glazer, the acting director of the Center for Poetry, and David Clausen, who will be reading a Swedish poem at tomorrow night's event. Welcome, Stephanie and David.
Thanks for having us.
How intriguing, a festival of listening. What happens at the Festival of Listening, Stephanie?
Sure. Yeah, we started this event when the center started. This is its 6th year, and all kinds of folks, students and community members, professors and invited guests come and read poems in languages other than English. So while there's a short preamble in English by the readers about the poems, basic themes, their connection to the language, whether they're native speakers or it's a language they've come to love, the poems aren't translated. We feel that this event is important because it's about the aesthetic experience of poetry.
Right.
Right?
It's language as music, it would seem.
That's exactly right.
Is that the point?
Okay. Yeah, it is. It is. And it's also just about getting other sounds in our ears that aren't typically there. The truth is, this community is incredibly diverse. We have a lot of strong refugee populations, and it's a joy to be able to invite some of those folks into the center.
And how is it this event has become your most popular, though? I am surprised to hear that.
Sure.
Considering English being the native language of most Americans, but an evening devoted to poetry in other languages is your biggest event.
Yeah, you know, I think it's something different. I think people are hungry for culture, but I also think that a lot of native speakers of other languages come from cultures where public recitation of poetry is commonplace, and I think that there's a hunger for that kind of space.
You must get people who say, who hear about the event and say, I really don't get this.
Yeah, I do.
What is the point of having an evening entirely devoted to poetry in foreign languages for which there is no translation? How do you respond to people who bring that up?
I invite them. And invariably they come, and then they come up to me after the event and they say, wow, I've never been to something like this. This was really amazing. What people do is, you know, the readers get up there and they talk about their connection to the language and their connection to the work. And it's always deeply emotional. It's always very personal for people.
Poetry is not as popular, I gather, in the United States as it seems to be in other countries. Any thoughts on why that is?
Oh, sure. You know, I think that America is sort of an instant gratification camp, and I think we've got some work to do in attentiveness and presence. I think poetry helps cultivate that kind of attitude.
David Clausen, any thoughts on that? You're reciting a poem in Swedish here. Any thoughts on why poetry lags in popularity in the United States?
Sure. I think that we like to think very literally, and when we think about big budget movies or we think about big, big stage shows or musicals, we like to think, I think, very literally. And poems ask us to think in terms of images that might vary from what we see in our everyday life. They ask us to see the mundane in a new light. And I think that Americans might be a little uncomfortable with that, since we're a bit we like to see things as they are, and we like to see things depicted the way we see them.
I think about this a lot, too. You know, abstraction just is not what it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, America seems to be more and more about the literal experience, about the pragmatic,
mm-hmm.
than it is about abstraction.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And poetry
right.
is an awful lot about abstraction,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Absolutely.
Is there something to that?
Yeah.
Which, yeah?
It is and it's not. I mean, I think that there's something to what you've said, Mark. We've just been through a recession, and I think there's a want for the actual, but there's also a hunger for the real. And what I mean when I say that is there's a hunger for real life, and what poetry is that distilled, right? So when we read poems, we are getting reality. We are getting the literal. We are getting objects in our kitchens, but we're getting them transformed. We're getting them kind of alchemized.
Okay. What languages do the people tend to speak who who attend this event? Is there a pattern there or not?
We try to mix it up every year. There's going to be Spanish, Urdu, Italian, Punjabi. Those are just
lots.
The ones off the top of my head. There'll be 16 readers.
So, David, tell us about the poem you're going to read.
Sure. The poem that I'm going to read is actually it's an untitled haiku by Tomas Tranströmer, who is a Swedish poet, most famous in the later half of the 20th century, but who just received the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2011. And this haiku you'll actually be able to see in translation as part of the Center for Poetry's Poetry in Motion project, which is a collaboration with the CATA system, where short poems or snippets of longer poems will be on placards in CATA buses all around Lansing. And so maybe some listeners will see the translated version of this poem on a bus they're taking sometime in the next couple of weeks or so.
I was not expecting you to go there. So we will see a Swedish haiku on a CATA bus.
Well, translated. You'll get it here first, untranslated, and then you'll... Maybe you'll recognize it. Some Swedish speakers, maybe, or who are listening, will recognize it later. So,
go right ahead. Let's experience this.
Sure, it's very short. Två rentjer i solgas, flugorna sör och sör fast skuggen vid marschen.
So there you go, Swedish haiku, a first here on current on Current State. Is it worth deconstructing what that means, or does that kind of flies in the face of the whole listening thing? Is that it?
I think so. Stephanie's nodding.
That was beautifully read too, by the way. So do you speak fluent Swedish, I would imagine?
I'm trying to learn. I have family members who are Swedish, and so that's my connection to the language. Is that I've been to Sweden and I've visited, you know, third and fourth cousins who are Swedish. I'm trying to learn. If anybody, wants to correct my pronunciation, they're welcome to come to the – any Swedish speakers out there, they're welcome to come to the festival tomorrow and, you know, set me straight. So
let's get into the details of the event then on Friday. Stephanie, how does it work, when and where?
Yeah, the event is free. It's open to the public. It's at 7 p.m. and it's at Scene Metro Space. There's always a good spread of international food. Families are welcome. Children are welcome. And we hope to see you there.
Very good. Stephanie Glazer is the acting director of MSU's Center for Poetry and the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities. David Clausen is an MSU student. Thanks to both of you for joining me.
Thank you.
Years ago, the strongest earthquake ever to strike Japan triggered a massive tsunami. The 9.0 magnitude quake killed nearly 19,000 people and left some 300,000 homeless. The event also damaged the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant, causing the world's worst radiation leak since the Chernobyl accident back in 1986. Now, on Monday, Michigan State University will commemorate the second anniversary of the Great East Japan Earthquake with an event at the campus's International Center. One of the speakers will be Dr. Ethan Siegel, a professor of history here at MSU and an expert on Japan. And Dr. Siegel joins me now in the studio. Nice to have you in here with us today.
Thank you for having me.
How has the recovery process come along here in these 2 years? What's working? What isn't working?
Yeah, it's unfortunately a somewhat mixed situation. It's been slow, and particularly for people in the region. I've had the chance to visit affected communities on four different research trips since March of 2011. And there are some very hopeful signs. Many of the port facilities have been reconstructed. And there's a lot of government aid that is going into the region. But there are also a number of significant issues that linger. As you mentioned, about 300,000 people still who cannot return to their homes, problems with unemployment, and of course, in the area around Fukushima, the issue of radiation and contamination is so severe that some communities may never be able to return home.
What about housing?
Housing also is a very serious concern. Most of the people who lost their homes are still living in temporarily erected housing communities. Those were initially supposed to have been in place for 2 years, but it appears they'll have to continue because of problems with rebuilding. It's unclear whether communities can rebuild in their former coastal locations because although some people say this tsunami was a once-in-a-thousand-year event, if it happened again tomorrow, no one could – I mean, there's no way to prevent it. So whether they can rebuild in those communities, whether higher seawalls will be necessary or even feasible, these kinds of issues still, unfortunately, have not yet been resolved.
What do we know about the after effects of the radiation leak from the nuclear power plant?
Well, it's interesting. There just was a study released earlier this year that suggests, although some smaller, higher, or some slightly raised incidents of thyroid cancer and other kinds of cancers have been detected, the numbers are not as high as they had perhaps anticipated, which I suppose is encouraging, although I think that the data is still very much out on this issue. The studies will have to continue. One study is anticipating 30 years of research following the victims of Fukushima. And another of our colleagues here on campus, Dr. James Trusco, has actually been following this issue very carefully in the College of Human Medicine.
Now, does this interplay with clean water issues? Is clean water being addressed? Is it available?
As far as drinking water goes to the temporary housing communities, as far as I'm aware, that has not been a problem. There has been a very serious problem, however, with the ocean water. Because of water leaked from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, the reason all these nuclear power plants are built along the ocean is they need water for cooling. And the way they had to try to deal with the emergency at Fukushima was by flooding the plant. And some of that water then gets released into the ocean. And it's almost impossible to trace once it's mixed in with the ocean water. So what this means for the fishing industry and many other seaside industries remains unclear.
So how are they contending with that? Do they have a plan for addressing that?
Well, there are a number of plans that are being discussed and debated, but I'm not sure anything that I think is really going to alleviate the situation. There was a study just, or a report rather, just released that TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company that runs the Fukushima plant, is planning to dilute some of this water that it is storing for cooling purposes and then release it into the ocean because it's running out of storage capacity. And many of us, me included, are quite unsure that that's really going to be adequate.
What's happening with regard to the country's approach to nuclear power in general after this?
Yeah, that also, unfortunately, is not entirely clear. The previous two prime ministers, Kan and Noda, who were part of the Democratic Party of Japan, which was in power at the time, expressed interest in moving Japan away from nuclear power. But the most recent elections, which put Prime Minister Abe, the current prime minister in power, from a different political party, he has backed away from that position and believes Japan should continue on moving ahead with nuclear power. There are many in the public who are opposed to this. Earlier on March 11th, there were over 300 rallies held around the country to express public opposition to this policy. The issue, though, is that Japan is very poor in natural resources, meaning fossil fuels. So back even in the 1950s, the nuclear power industry was very successful in convincing politicians and the public that Japan needed nuclear power. And those issues of a lack of natural resources remain. So although there are many who would like to see Japan move to more renewable resources, wind, solar, and the like, developing that infrastructure would take a lot of time. What they've done in the short term has been to import fossil fuels, which is very expensive, and of course does nothing to help problems with greenhouse gases and the like. So the situation, again, is not entirely clear.
Japan has such a long and curious history with nuclear power, which you just alluded to. There was, of course, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but later the Japanese government, as you say, went all in on nuclear power as an energy source, and it's even become prominently featured in Japanese popular culture to an extent, in anime and manga. Tell us about that.
Well, indeed, as you suggest, the government early on drew very careful distinctions between nuclear weapons, such as that had been used against Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and nuclear power. And they convinced successfully the majority of the public that nuclear power was safe. One of the great post-war animated heroes of, say, the 1950s and 1960s was the character Tetsuan Otomu, who we know in English as Astro Boy, the same character drawn by the great manga artist Osamu Tezuka. And he was a robot boy. The story is somewhat Pinocchio-like, perhaps, but unlike Pinocchio, he is powered by a nuclear heart, a nuclear active, you know, energy heart. And he was a great hero, a great friend to humanity, and one way that people could see nuclear power as a safe and friendly resource. This continues with many more, you know, recent anime and manga images, and I'm told that even school children in some schools are shown animated videos to help convince them that nuclear power is safe. The perhaps more important issue, though, is where many of these power plants are built. These are in communities, oceanside communities, that have few other economic alternatives. If fishing is not successful, then there aren't many resources for these towns. And so they agree to allow power plants to be built because of all the money that the industry brings to their town, both jobs and investments. And so they've taken big risks that I imagine some of those communities now regret.
Dr. Ethan Siegel is a professor of history here at Michigan State and an expert on Japan. On Monday, he will be amongst the speakers at the second anniversary event commemorating the Great East Japan Earthquake at MSU's International Center. Dr. Siegel, many thanks.
Thank you.
.5 WKAR in Current State. Violinist Anne Sophie Mutter is one of the true superstars of classical music. Since her first concerts on the world's most prestigious stages, Mutter has inspired audiences around the globe with recitals, concert performances, and dozens of recordings. She finishes a U.S. recital tour tonight in Ann Arbor's Hill Auditorium. Anne Sophie Mutter spoke with WKAR's Peter Wharf a few days ago. They talked about everything from tonight's program to a couple of family members and traveling companions near and dear to Anne Sophie's heart.
This is a program that I'm fascinated by in that these are all such strong works, but individually not ones that you might think of as go-to standard repertoire violin recital pieces. But they all work together in a way that speaks to each other in that these are in some ways standard forms, sonatas, the partita, but they're being looked at from another angle, twisted in a different way.
Yeah, that's very true. Actually, that is what the red thread is, so to speak, in this repertoire. We start with Mozart 379, which is a very unusual piece,
yes,
as you know, not only because it's not the usual free movement setting, and it also came about in a time where Mozart literally was kicked out from Salzburg at the court, and it's a piece which has unusual outrage. Really rattling at the bars of the prison which he felt being in at that time, being stuck in Salzburg. So quite unusual. It starts serene, but then, you know, it's Mozart at its wildest. At the end, he doesn't forget to do his curtsy and, you know, be a good boy again. And we move on to Schubert, who with his fantasy has written one of the few most outstanding pieces for violin and piano ever. The violin and piano are really singing.
And such equal partners.
It's such equal partnership, yes. Mm. And then there's Lutoslawski, whose 100th birthday we are celebrating this year, and a man who has been of extreme significance in my life because he is the first contemporary composer whose pieces I have premiered. This Partita, who in its original version is for violin and piano and is going to be played obviously in the recital program in that version, has been orchestrated by Lutoslawski because he wanted to write a proper violin concerto in the 80s, but sadly didn't have enough time, and then he died. So both versions are very dear to my heart. And then at the end of the program, we also want to have really fun.
Yes.
We play this fabulous sonata by Saint-Saëns. And I hope it's great fun for the audience as well, who has traveled through such diversity and also through such really deep and serious music, as well as, you know, having at the end of the evening something to just lean back and be bewildered, hopefully.
Again, this Saint-Saëns is not a piece that you hear very frequently on violin recital programs, but after you hear a piece like this, you might think, I wish it were played more often. That's my reaction to it.
Yeah, it takes a very skillful pianist, first of all, to pull it off. There is only that much you can rehearse, but the rest is really up to the moment and sensing where things are going and where your musical partner is heading off to, and there you go. You just hang on the tails and fly with.
I must ask you one more question, if you will allow it. Are you traveling with Bonnie and Clyde these days?
Oh, how do you know?
I've done my homework.
Always ready to rob a bank, you see.
I am also a dog person.
Oh, they are so gorgeous. Mine are short-haired, wire-haired, I think.
Short-wired-haired, yes.
Yeah, they are great hunters. Yeah. I mean, the name is, you know, programmed, so to speak. And it's, of course, great fun to travel with them, mostly in the German-speaking countries, because the planes, you know, it's more difficult. But it's just wonderful to have this relationship with dogs. I had dogs all my life, and it's a great way to enjoy climbing in the mountains even more.
Anne-Sophie, it's been such a great pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was violinist Anne-Sophie Mutter with WKAR's Peter Whorf. Mutter finishes her 2013 U.S. recital tour tonight at 7:30 at Ann Arbor's Hill Auditorium. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we will have an in-depth look at the Lansing Financial Health Team report. Former Mayor Dave Hollister rode herd on this ambitious project. Mayor Bernero wanted an ambitious financial blueprint for Lansing's long-term future. David Hollister joins me live here in the Current State studio, along with the author of the final report, MSU's Eric Scorsone. This may be the city of Lansing's future, a lot of it that is contained in this report. So we look forward to that. Join us for it. We will also check in with Israeli screenwriter Guy Mearson about his film showing this weekend. That and more on tomorrow's Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Whorf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer, thanks to Aaron Young for engineering and Gabby Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by Fluke Hearing, finding ways to help people hear like nature intended, with 16 locations including Lansing, Jackson, Grand Rapids, and Ann Arbor. FlukeHearing.com. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. Alumni.msu.edu.